All right, please be seated.
Good morning. This morning we are here in the case of Jama Ijama versus Jason C. Gonzalez. Could you state your appearances, please? All right, good morning. We also have with us Wisconsin Lutheran High School. If you could please stand, we'd like to welcome you. All right, nice to see you here today. Is a justice meeting afterwards? All right, it's your lucky day. Justice Rebecca Bradley is going to meet with you afterwards. She can't talk to you about the merits of this case that you'll be hearing, but she could discuss all sorts of other things. So think of some really great, difficult questions to ask her, because she does her best job with really tough ones. Okay? All right.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
I have every confidence in you, Justice Bradley. Go ahead and have a seat. Okay, we also have Justice Ann Walsh Bradley on the phone here today, and Justice Karofsky is not participating in this case, just so we've cleared the decks on those things. Mr. Engel, you have 25 minutes, Mr. Rosh, 30 minutes, followed by rebuttal of 5 minutes. So when your light comes on, that means you have 5 minutes left in your 25-minute remarks. Okay, go right ahead then. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. This Court should reverse the Court of Appeals. The Court should adhere to stare decisis, it should reaffirm Hicks, and it should restore the previously existing bright-line rule that gave us finality in litigation and consistency in the law. To do otherwise opens a can of worms. The concrete question before the Court seems simple enough. May a criminal who has pleaded guilty to one charge maintain a malpractice claim against his former defense attorney over another count in the same criminal case as to which the criminal asserts the conviction was the result of negligent representation? The Court of Appeals answered yes in a decision that appears to overrule its own precedent, but also that of this Court. And weighty issues underlie that question, and they compel the Court to reverse the Court of Appeals. And to get to that, I'd like to sort of look at two perspectives on this case. The first is what I would call the macro or big picture perspective. When we look at this case in relation to Wisconsin jurisprudence in general, what we see is that adjustments to rules like the actual innocence rules are best left to the legislature. This is right in line with Justice Hagedorn's concurrence in Skinzalewski. And the reason is there are many stakeholders here. There's the defense bar, there are malpractice insurers, there are judges and prosecutors, there are people who have been done wrong by their former defense counsel, and there's the public at large. And unlike this Court, the legislature has the ability to gather their input and to incorporate their perspectives. The actual innocence rule has been around in Wisconsin for nearly 20 years. And that means that various groups in that ecosystem I just described have developed reliance on it. So we change it at our peril, especially since stare decisis is a central pillar of our justice system. And there's nothing very compelling about this case to justify a departure from it. And that brings me to Justice Dalit's dissent in Skinzalewski, where she indicated she would be open to the idea of an exception to the actual innocence rule if there were a constitutional or statutory ground for it. And there's none of that here.
Why is this an exception? I know you frame it that way in your brief, but I don't read what the Court of Appeals did as an exception. I read this as actual innocence applies to the charge at which you are challenging or seeking relief from legal malpractice. That seems pretty clear and seems pretty consistent with Hicks. So why is this an exception?
This is an exception because when you read Hicks, the language is expansive. It speaks of the crimes, and it talks about, in Talmadge, the get-out-of-jail-free card. And the Court of Appeals is basically going back and saying, well, we weren't thinking about that at the time when we decided those cases, but I think we owe it to the Court of Appeals to presume that the people who wrote those decisions, and again in Skinzalewski, this Court, that that they were perspicacious jurists who thought about the implications of what they were saying and said what they meant.
So is there anything in Skindalewski that you believe somehow prohibits a reading of Hicks to say what defense is asking it to say? Or the defense is asking it to say here? I'm still failing to follow the exception piece. So far I've heard you say some language in a court of appeals case talking about get out of jail free. But what else can you point to that makes this an exception?
Well, I would actually answer that by returning to one of the key underpinnings of Hicks, which is that public respect for and confidence in the justice system is going to be undermined if we allow guilty people to pursue claims just because they were innocent of something else.
Okay. The claim here is that he's innocent of the sexual assault, and that's the claim that the legal malpractice is surrounding. There is no proof right now. There has been no hearing to show that he's guilty of the sexual assault.
That's correct.
And he's claiming innocence, actual innocence of it. The next step would be, if we allow it, to have a hearing to determine whether he actually is or he actually isn't. How does that undermine Hicks?
I think that the Court of Appeals developed this term, split innocence, which is sort of the justification for their reasoning. It's a smokescreen to distract from the fact that they're trying to change what they did in the past. When I read Hicks and I read Talmadge, it looks to me like the use of and so forth is inclusive. It's an and, not an or, when we're talking about convictions.
Counsel, respectfully, I guess I don't see that what the Court of Appeals did here as contrary to precedent. I think this is an open question that we get to resolve. So I understand you disagree with that premise and you make arguments on that basis. But it still leaves the question. And when I look at this is one of these kind of rare cases where we're not reading a statute to figure out what the law is. This is one of those cases where we're exercising our common law responsibilities to determine the scope of a tort claim. So talk to me at that level here. Why should the rule be what you are proposing?
Okay. Well, I promised at the start kind of two views of the case. Let's turn to the second one because I think this gets to what you're saying. If the court affirms the Court of Appeals, then what happens next is exactly what Justice Dallet says. We're going to go forward with the malpractice case. And what that means is HH is going to have to testify, first at a deposition, and then, if the case survives, a motion for summary judgment at trial. We've got to remember that one very plausible reason that the state may have elected to drop the sexual assault charge on the second go-round is that HH may have lost her appetite for this. Now, we have, since that case, we've gotten Marcy's Law in place, but it's not clear what, if any, protection that offers victims in the civil context. And the court can't possibly want to send a message to victims that even though we offer them some protections, we're opening up a door. The closure of a criminal case is not closure for them because a door is opening for them to be hailed back into court in order to be portrayed as unreliable or malingerers or liars, so that the people who committed the crimes against them can prevail on malpractice claims.
It sounds like a really good argument for not having the actual innocence rule. Is that what you're arguing to us?
No. No, I'm...
Because if this was just a sexual assault case and there were no other charges, that's exactly what would happen, right? The victim has to testify or however the state goes forward. So it sounds like a great reason that we just cut all this out and no more actual innocence needing to be shown.
No, I think the exact opposite. Because what JAMA's going to have to do is he's going to have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that on January 29th, 2012, the intoxicated HH first was capable of consent and then actually did consent. And
not if there's no actual innocence claim. Wouldn't he have to only prove that his attorney there was legal malpractice in what his attorney did?
I misunderstood your question.
And that's what I'm asking. Yeah. So it sounds like you're arguing we don't need that actual innocence hurts victims. It actually may.
No. In my view, it protects victims because it forecloses that from having to happen.
Okay. Please explain.
Well, because the claim should be barred and we shouldn't have to go there. I'm arguing you should reverse the Court of Appeals. So if you do, then I think the case ends. And that doesn't have to happen to HH.
But Justice Dowd's point is that does seem to require some litigation over the merits of it, over what happened. And so at least one of the consequences would be more likelihood that the victim would testify?
Well, I think the victim's probably going to have to testify one way or another. I guess I can't say that I foresee that in every case just because I don't know, but even if there were no actual innocence rule, there would still have to be a showing that the result in the criminal case would have been better for JAMA had Gonzalez's representation not been deficient. And I think that's going to require the case within the case that a standard malpractice claim requires, and that's going to require the victim's testimony.
One question in thinking through the proper sort of way to think about this, I mean, there's a few options, for how to resolve this. One is what the Court of Appeals did. You could adopt some sort of broader course of conduct or transaction, which California does. Justice Scalia used to say the rule of law is, the law of rules, which, isn't always the case with our statutes or other kinds of laws. But it seems to me in this context that the clearer and cleanest way we can lay something out, the better that is for everybody involved. The Court of Appeals approach seems to me to be a pretty clean and clear dividing line approach. Tell me why that you agree or disagree, or why you think some other approach is a good, clear rule.
Well, I think the cleanest and clearest is not even to delve into the question of split innocence and just to say that if you're guilty of one or more of the crimes of which you were accused, your claim is barred. That is, in my view, the most efficient way to resolving these cases.
So even if there's, 15 different completely unrelated charges, so long as one of them, doesn't fit into that standard, that nobody can bring any claim in that case altogether.
Well, I mean, that's the virtue of a bright line rule, right? Mm-hmm. It does have harsh results at times, but it makes clear and consistent administration possible. And so if the right to sue becomes a matter of sort of degree of injustice, then the problem becomes where to draw the line. How innocent does someone have to be in order to get their claim into court? For example, I think reading the Court of Appeals decision, if I'm accused of a crime and I get my conviction overturned, but I'm guilty of a lesser included crime, I think I get to sue in malpractice. And that seems problematic to me and not consistent with the logic of Hicks.
The transactionally related test that was adopted and applied in California is a clean and clear rule. Do you disagree?
It's the second best solution, I would say. Yes, I like that one. I was surprised when the Court of Appeals, having certified the question to this court, or attempted to certify the question to the court, citing that case, that the case did not figure at all in the eventual decision, because it seemed to me like the transactionally related test would be another way of minimizing the ensuing litigation and keeping things clear and concise.
Well, and it's a concept that's already applied in Wisconsin criminal law, right? We have a transactionally related test for what charges may be included in the information, and this case strikes me as a perfect example of that. We have the same victim, and we have crimes against the same victim occurring in the same place. There's a little bit of a debate, it seems, about how temporally connected they were, but whether it's 90 minutes or a couple of hours, but it was the same victim, and the crimes, alleged crime and the convicted crime occurred in the same place, right?
I agree with you 100%. So, what the Court of Appeals decision does is it changes the law with some pretty far-reaching consequences. For example, it changes the dynamics of post-conviction case resolution because it now creates an economic incentive to enter certain pleas. Each count that's dismissed in exchange for a plea becomes potential fodder for a malpractice claim. And that might affect prosecutors making offers because they might not want to hand that ticket into court out. It might affect the way defense attorneys advise their clients. It might affect the client's objectives in the post-conviction proceeding, and maybe even judges' willingness to follow recommendations because they see this other layer that's going on there. Malpractice insurers are going to take note of this decision because a large amount of criminal defense in this state is practiced by solo and small firm practitioners who have been relatively cheap to insure in malpractice until now because it's been relatively hard to sue them until now. And even if most of those suits that, you know, hypothetically get filed get settled for nuisance value, they'll still occupy the time of the courts and counsel. And then we get the question of whether public defenders get immunity from malpractice suits. Well, if they do, isn't that an equal protection problem, because then someone represented by a public defender has different rights than someone who's not? Okay, now what about appointed counsel? Do they get immunity? This is going to have to get litigated. And then we've got the horrible question.
Counsel, that's true no matter what. I mean, if you're going to allow, you know, criminal malpractice, you know, criminal defense attorney malpractice claims, you know, on a criminal case, you're going to get all that stuff. I mean, that's true no matter what. I mean, you could theoretically have a rule, you know, that says, you know, you can't sue your criminal defense attorney no matter what, and then we'd clean all that stuff up. But, you know, this is what that, you know, this relates to that category of cases where some claims somebody says they're innocent of, some, it's, maybe that's a wide breadth of cases, but maybe it's not. The concerns you're raising apply no matter what. If we're in this world, I'm not sure why that distinguishes any particular approach.
Well, you're right that there are situations in which each of those issues could arise, and so my advocacy here is to minimize the number of them. And so my proposal is, my bright line rule proposal is one way of keeping that to a minimum, and then the second is the transactionally related approach, which cuts it down at least some.
Do we have any evidence from any other cases or from any other states that do this stuff about how prevalent, or in Wisconsin, about how prevalent this kind of litigation is, and about whether the different approaches to it, what incentives they create? I feel like we're kind of just spitballing here, you know? Like, how's this going to play out? How's this going to affect things? And to be honest, I don't know. I can guess. I can use my best judgment. But do we have any evidence that would be helpful?
I think there's a paucity of it, to be honest. I think if there were a reservoir of it out there, we would have cited it in our brief. The Court of Appeals would have dug it up. What we can say anecdotally is that we've had this rule for coming on 20 years, and this is the first time this particular issue has arisen. So that suggests it's not that common.
But I thought your argument was that this opens up the floodgates.
I think once, and this gets back to my original point about Hicks, I think people rely on Hicks for the proposition that this sort of claim isn't allowed. And now that they see it is allowed, we might see a lot more of this.
I haven't been able to find any case beyond the California case that the parties cited. Are you aware of any other jurisdictions that have addressed this so-called split innocence situation?
No, the Court of Appeals referenced an Iowa case, which wasn't exactly on point, and it's especially not on point because there isn't an actual innocence rule in Iowa, but they did, it was a little bit off point, but that was the next closest thing, I thought. To be candid, there just isn't much of that. And then just getting back to the list of questions that you think probably arise every time, there's also the question of how do we measure damages, which I think in this case is an especially thorny one. And I grant that that's not necessarily a proper consideration at a motion to dismiss stage, but that's another thing that's coming here. So, again, Wisconsin adopted its actual innocence rule back in 2002 with this court reaffirmed it in Skinzalewski just last year. And what we've taken these cases to mean is that the right to counsel in criminal cases does not include the right to pursue monetary compensation for counsel's deficiency if you're guilty of a crime. So, for example, in Skinzalewski, the plaintiff ought not to have been convicted at all. I mean, Hicks kind of stands for the position that even a criminal who ought not to have been convicted if they're guilty doesn't get a malpractice claim. Skinzalewski says even a criminal who legally couldn't have been convicted doesn't get a malpractice claim if they're guilty. And what we've got here is a situation where Jama admits that he should have been convicted on the theft charge, and the harm he claims to have suffered is that he was essentially penalized more than he could have been for the two misdemeanors to which he pleaded guilty. So, again, Jama is not an innocent person. And one of the passages in Skinzalewski that was cited by the Court of Appeals was paragraph 18, which talks about the difference between the cases wherein the plaintiff was someone who got a sentence longer than the law allowed versus Skinzalewski's case. And the point made in that paragraph was that the penalty, when the conviction didn't support a sentence as long as was assigned, that was entirely due to the lawyer's error. And I don't think we can say the same thing about whatever Jama has suffered here.
Isn't that exactly the claim? The claim here is that he wound up sitting in jail longer because of a crime which he says he's actually innocent of, which is a sexual assault. He couldn't be held any longer on what he actually got convicted of. That's exactly the claim here, right?
That is what he claims, but there's a nuance to it,
okay,
which is that the only reason he was incarcerated at all is that he violated his probation conditions. He received a probationary sentence and would not, well, he was incarcerated. I take that back. He was incarcerated between conviction and sentencing. His bond was revoked. But then he was out again on probation, and he only spent most of his incarcerated time in the clink because he violated his conditions. So I don't think we can say that it's 100% due to any legal malpractice.
Okay, I will have to look through the brief, and I'm actually going to ask your opposing counsel on that, because I don't understand that to be argued anywhere here before, but maybe I missed something.
Yeah, it is in our brief, but maybe
that
we didn't.
Somehow this was related to his probation and not to the fact that he was held on a sexual assault charge that he was not convicted on.
Right. So he receives a probationary sentence on the sexual assault charge. And then
it was vacated, correct? The sexual assault charge goes away.
Right, right. It was vacated.
So you're talking about the probation on the sexual assault?
Yes.
Okay, it's vacated. It doesn't exist.
But it wasn't vacated until later.
Okay. Come on. That conviction is gone. It's gone. You're saying it's okay because they may have sentenced him on something he was actually may have been actually innocent of, and because he spent some time on probation on that and violated potential probation on a sentence that may have been inaccurately or illegally imposed, that somehow justifies? I'm having a hard time here.
Well, I'm not saying, and don't get me wrong, I think if we're to be honest here, I can't say that he's suffered zero harm. That's true. But I think the degree of the harm that he suffered is he's got a contribution to that he's made, which was violating his conditions. He did not have to be incarcerated.
Should we be considering that the crimes to which of which he was convicted were transactionally related, occurred during the same evening as the sexual assault charge that was dismissed?
I think so.
Why?
Well, so again, with respect to the sexual assault charge, it's not like law enforcement picked Mr. Jama's name out of a hat because they were looking for someone to convict. They have video of him entering the apartment, they have his DNA on HH's clothing, and they've got the property that they recovered from him that belonged to HH. And so, yeah, this is all one night's work. And that's, I think, another thing that makes it problematic under Hicks. So he admits to being with HH. He admits he committed a crime against her. And but for those actions, there's no reason to think that he ever would have been charged for anything.
Is stealing a video game console transactionally related to sexual assault?
So this, I think, I mean, so obviously they have different elements. That's true. When we the phrase transactionally related, when we're talking about it in the Wilkinson versus Zalen case, the second California case, their definition of transactionally related is facts from which it could be inferred that some action of the defendant giving rise to the dismissed count was also involved in the admitted count. And I think we've clearly got that here. Wisconsin's statute is maybe a little bit different. And the case I was looking at, and I don't practice criminal law, so I apologize if I'm not citing the best precedent here, was State versus Salinas, whether the charges are closely enough related to exist in the same criminal complaint. So are there common factors of substantial importance? That's one of the factors. I think there are here. Same victim, the same location, same time. Did one charge arise out of the investigation of the other? It's sort of hard to tell which one came first here, but are the times close in time or in location? Yes. Do the crimes involve the same victim? Yes. So I think under Wisconsin's test, even though I don't know that we have the same transactionally related standard, I think it's pretty analogous.
The transactionally related standard that I'm most used to applying relates to a prelim and then charges that flow after the prelim that weren't specifically discussed at the prelim. That's one test. Having said that, as a prosecutor and as a judge who's tried a lot of cases, sometimes you have cases where it involves, let's say, an armed robbery, and then someone goes, they end up being in detox when they're in jail for the armed robbery, and so they go to the hospital, and they escape the hospital where they're in custody, and then they run through the bushes down the road to carjack a little old lady's car, and in that time they then go on a high-speed chase through multiple counties to the. And when you're trying this, believe it or not, that's a real case. When you're trying these cases, that may be in one complaint, even though the carjacking and the initial armed robbery might be very different. The attempted homicide of the officer may be very different than the escape and the other elements and things. And some of these things can go on for a lengthy period of time, but as someone trying the case, you want to give the jury the whole picture, and they might as well get the whole picture and decide all the charges at once. So I have to tell you, I have a little trouble with the notion of transactionally related being some sort of test, like it might be applied at a prelim regarding charges, because sometimes a complaint tells a story of what happened during a period of time, even though the charges may not have elements in common or other things in common. So I'm careful to use that language in the context with which I'm familiar with it. Are you really asking us to adopt transactionally related as the test here?
I see my time is up, so I'll answer very briefly. The answer is that's my fallback position. But I think even if you don't want to use the phrase transactionally related, it's clear that under any definition of that term, these crimes were. And
okay. All right,
I'll
thank you.
Yield the podium.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am attorney Kevin Rosch, and I represent the respondent. The novel issue before the court, whether a criminal malpractice plaintiff has met Wisconsin's actual innocence pleading standard when he asserts innocence to some, but not all, of the underlying criminal convictions for which he was represented.
Hey, let me just go through that same scenario that I gave you, which I know sounds crazy.
Sure.
But it was real. Armed robbery, detox, go in the hospital, law enforcement's guarding you, escape, alleged attempt to shoot the officer, go down, run through some bushes, hop in a little old lady's car as she's warming it up outside, and then, you know, take off and then get in a high-speed chase through multiple counties, which ultimately ends in something else. Having said that, when that person goes to trial and they say, you know, I did this, I did that. They plead not guilty. Everything's being tried. And the argument to the jury is, I did this, I did that, I did this, but I didn't do that.
I didn't shoot at the officer. In order to sort of gain credibility, if you will, that, you know, you're willing to accept responsibility for what you did do. You just don't want to accept responsibility for what you didn't do. And then the jury might come back not guilty on the attempted shooting of the officer, but guilty on the other things. Those things all are part of a story that's being told to the jury. So is your position that if one part of that story, there's actual innocence, the analysis is different? Or do you need to prove actual innocence of the whole string of events?
So here, Chief Justice, I believe there are a few different ways this can be analyzed. So obviously, petitioners had suggested the transactionally related approach, and we have a key difference in how that is actually applied. However, I believe what the court here has actually decided last year in Skinjaleski, they have actually created a blueprint for how not only this split innocence issue should be analyzed, but how future split innocence issues should be analyzed. Now, the court in Skinjaleski asserts that an attorney's error does not sever the causal link between a criminal defendant's culpable behavior and the time spent incarcerated if that person is actually guilty. However, the court went on to state that once a defendant is incarcerated beyond that statutory maximum amount of time, the perceived damages are causally unrelated from that underlying criminal conduct and instead is relatable only to an attorney's negligence. So in expanding on that, in taking that same reasoning, we are looking at, in any split innocence issue, we have at least one crime that has been admitted to, and we have at least one crime which, or a conviction where damages are being asserted here. So using Skinjaleski's approach, I believe we need to look at what is the actual admitted to crime, and then is that, and we have to also look at, are the damages being alleged causally related back to that specific admitted count? Because we can't look at the cause, because Mr. Jama, in this instance, he is asserting innocence to sexual assault convictions for which he served over 2.5 years in prison, he was forced to register with the federal sex registry, absolute sobriety, and additional civil restrictions, all because of it was related to this sexual assault. So again, here, the difference between a theft and a sexual assault, not only on its face are different crimes, they are punished different by the legislature in statute. Theft of movable property under $2,500 is punishable up to 9 months, whereas second degree sexual assault is punishable up to 40 years. So not only do we have this distinction in our criminal code, but the actual acts needed to commit both of these is completely distinct and separate. And so I believe even if the California transactionally related approach is adopted, Mr. Jama has still adequately alleged a claim for legal malpractice. And here, the petitioner's counsel correctly identified how California does look at these transactionally related offenses. However, that quote comes from the dissent here, because the actual Wilkinson majority, they didn't actually give a great analysis as to what transactionally related crimes are. And that's because they had judicially noticed facts that the two crimes at issue were transactionally related. So again, this isn't to say that we should adopt the transactionally related approach. It's just to say that this is not a specific case that would require such an adoption, because even under this more stringent standard, Mr. Jama has still asserted a plausible claim.
Do you, counsel, do you agree with the Court of Appeals analysis? Do you have any quibbles with it?
I do not. I don't have any quibbles with how the court analyzed, because they took a very specific analysis of the public policy implementation from the very beginning with Hicks v. Nunnery. They analyzed Talmadge, and they analyzed this court's decision in Skinjaleski. And so I believe they took a very thorough and methodical approach to determining a novel issue And they certainly did not create an exception to the actual innocence rule. And they basically looked at the facts of this case and applied it to how the court first looked at the actual innocence rule in creating it, the Talmadge court, and then this court in Scangelesky. And if we go look to the actual underlying analysis in the Hicks court took five, I believe, bullet point public policy holdings. Now, Hicks was particularly concerned with ensuring that a person who has actually committed a criminal offense is not able to recover for that specific criminal offense. Now, what the court is additionally trying to hold there with their public policy analysis is that they don't want to shift responsibility from an actual guilty criminal's conduct to that of his negligent defense counsel. And so here, the same issues that are presented in Hicks aren't applicable because here, Mr. Jama does not seek damages for the theft crime. Because, and additionally, he has served the statutory maximum amount of time and then some for that theft. So here, Your Honors, I just don't see how the Hicks court, essentially the Court of Appeals applied Hicks exactly as it. And when we look at the Talmadge analysis, while there is some language that the court used referring to a get-out-of-jail-free card, there are clear distinctions involved here. First, the Talmadge court was, when you look at how they were analyzing public policy and how they were looking at that analysis, they were more concerned with what are the recoverable damages being. So, in Talmadge, he was convicted on 15 separate counts of sexual assault. He was 70 years old at the time of his civil suit, so each one of these sexual assaults would have kept him in prison for more than his life's expectancy. And the court, in analyzing what are the possible damages that can be recovered here, they came to the conclusion that even if he asserts innocent, or even if he has his convictions vacated, 14 of his 15 convictions vacated, he would still be serving the rest of his natural life in prison. And so they were looking at the specific facts of that case and possible recoverable injury. And that is the distinction here, as Mr. Jama has clearly asserted that he has recoverable injury that can be attributable only to the convicted or the wrongful convictions of sexual assault.
Can you address opposing counsel's claim that because he violated probation when he was originally placed on probation for the sexual assault, that takes away his ability to be actually innocent, which is what I understood counsel to say after thinking about that exchange. So can you respond to that?
Certainly, Justice Stallett. That particular instance, the probation sentence is still stemming from the sexual assault conviction and sentence. So Mr. Jama, if he was not convicted, he would not have been sentenced to probation, and subsequently his probation would not have been remitted and him having to serve additional time in jail. However, in this instance, and again, there is a possibility that down the road, if this case is remanded, that there will be a damages argument. However, here it is clearly asserted that there are some damages, and there are damages that don't extend just to wrongful incarceration here. Mr. Jama has also asserted damages as to the result of having to register as a sex offender for a number of years, which in a civil legal malpractice setting, I believe you'd be able to recover damages for damage to reputation. So here, Mr. Jama has had to deal with the stigma of being a registered sex offender for a number of years, and that has impacted his life significantly. So at the motion to dismiss stage, we are still trying to assert if whether or not there are actual damages being asserted we're not necessarily going to dive into because we don't have the facts yet as to the amount of those damages. But here, Mr. Jama has clearly alleged under any set of facts that there are actual damages stemming directly from his wrongful criminal conviction of second-degree sexual assault.
Setting aside the issue of your client's allegations of damages, we are sitting in the realm of applying public policy, which some of us might find discomfort with. Statutes are a little bit easier sometimes to follow. Do you think the Court of Appeals decision gives enough weight to the considerations of the victim in this case? I'm looking at some of the public policy considerations we are supposed to apply, and quoting from the cases, and there aren't that many of them, that are precedential here. Tort law provides damages only for harms to the plaintiff's legally protected interests, and the liberty of a guilty criminal is not one of them. Your client is guilty of an offense for which he did serve jail time. There's no dispute about that, that he victimized the victim in this case. Another public policy consideration is that permitting a convicted criminal to pursue a legal malpractice claim without requiring proof of innocence would shock the public conscience, engender disrespect for courts, and generally discredit the administration of justice. On those two particular factors, do you think the Court of Appeals opinion and your argument, for that matter, give enough weight to those public policy considerations about how does it look to the public and to this victim in particular that a convicted criminal can recover as a result of his criminal behavior ultimately?
I do believe they give enough consideration, Justice Bradley, and the reasoning for that is because they were looking at what are the specific crimes alleged here. So right now, the only actual convicted crime here is that of theft of movable property under $2,500.
I understand that, but we still have a victim who, looking at the allegations of the complaint as they relate to just the theft claim, he noticed the victim who was clearly intoxicated. He offered to help her into her apartment. And then, setting aside the sexual assault allegations, those convictions were vacated, he stole from her. And she was found on the floor of her apartment.
So, Your Honor, so Justice Bradley, I believe some of these facts are disputed. And when we look at the underlying malpractice that was committed, the entire case was essentially tainted by a failure to look at the actual facts that were being asserted by Mr. Jama. Mr. Gonzalez, in that case, and this was found at a Mockner hearing, he literally made up his own facts that were completely contrary to what Mr. Jama has asserted.
And that all relates to the sexual assault, but he pled guilty and was convicted of stealing from this woman. Is that right?
I'm sorry. Could you clarify that, Justice Bradley?
Your client was convicted of theft, correct?
Correct.
Is there a dispute that he entered her apartment and stole from her?
No.
Okay. So we have a victim here, and if this claim proceeds, she will necessarily have to testify, I think, right, during that that trial.
That is an absolute possibility that she may have to testify. However, in this instance, Mr. Jama has also been wronged. He has had his freedom taken away. He has had to face his friends and family as a convicted sex offender. He has had to live with this stigma for years, and this is all attributable not directly to his theft, but this is attributable to his attorney's own negligence and his attorney's ineffectiveness.
I understand that argument, but the issue here, the public policy considerations that I'm talking about seem to create this bright line rule, looking at it saying, okay, maybe he shouldn't have been convicted of that one offense, but he was in fact convicted of another offense. He's a convicted criminal, so we're not going to allow recovery in those circumstances because it would shock the public conscience.
I believe that analysis would essentially undermine what this court was considering in Skinjaleski when they were concerned with what is the actual criminal conduct and what is the causal damages that we're actually looking at here. So I believe this court in Skinjaleski was basically opening the door for a possible exception to the actual innocence rule in the specific cases of if somebody was incarcerated longer than the statutory maximum amount of time. So in that case, there's still this possible avenue for recovery. So in these cases, I think there is a balance that you have to look at as to, yes, maybe there should be some consideration for the party who was actually damaged by the admitted to crime, but then there is also, you have to balance that with the injustice as what's being alleged here. And what's being alleged here is a significant loss of Mr. Jama's freedom and life-altering consequences for his...
Counsel,
Hold on one second. I think Justice Bradley has been sort of poised to ask a question. Is that accurate? Ann Walsh Bradley?
Yes, thank you. I'm concerned about how wide this will open things up. Arguably, the facts that you set forth can arguably be construed as extreme, stealing a video game and a controller for it, you know, ending up a couple of years in prison, sex registry, etc. But what I'm concerned about is the everyday plea that happens or the everyday actions that happen in courthouses throughout this state that may not really have the kind of extreme facts that you have alleged here, and that it will open up a cause of action for the mundane. What's to bridle this? Your opposing counsel has an alternative, and that is a transactional analysis. But if that's not acceptable to you, how can you assuage my fears that this opens it up for lawsuits on rather mundane facts?
Absolutely, Justice Bradley. I don't believe the transactionally related approach is appropriate. However, this court in Skinjaleski has already provided a blueprint for how the court should look at future split innocence issues. And what I mean by that is I keep going back to, in any matter of split innocence, you have an actual admitted crime, and you have a crime for which you are certain you are innocent of and asserting damages. So again, we are looking at, you have to look at the separate culpable conduct, and you have to look at if the actual culpable conduct of the admitted count is causally related to the damages, then I believe you have not met the pleading standard, because again, not just the actual innocence element, but every single legal malpractice claim concerns you have to plead causation and you have to plead damages. So I think if we're taking this approach where you're looking at what is the admitted to crime and can there be some distinction between the damages that are being asserted and that crime. So I think that would alleviate your concerns as to how we're going to look at these cases in the future. And I believe that is the proper approach to be taking here and not fully adopting California's transactionally related approach.
Is your argument, just to summarize, basically that, listen, these are really hard to prove anyway, and so we don't need to be too concerned about all those? Is that, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I just want to understand what you're saying.
To an extent, Justice Hagedorn, I would agree with that, because we've been looking at the actual innocence rule in Wisconsin for nearly two decades, and this is the first time this issue of split innocence has been approached to the court. So I don't believe that there is going to be a can of worms being opened up simply because of this.
Counsel, how would your argument play when a defendant is tried and brought before the jury on three counts, and the jury convicts him of two and acquits him of one? His attorney did a good job, but hey, you know, the jury didn't find that it was proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was guilty of that third charge. Can he bring a claim for actual innocence under your theory?
If I'm understanding your question right, Justice Rogan-Zack, I believe he could if there is actual negligence that led to that guilty conviction. So, in addition...
Well, he can allege that if his lawyer had been a better lawyer, he wouldn't have gotten convicted of anything. I mean, that's... Here, you have a lot of help, because clearly there was a problem, and the trial court took care of the problem by vacating the convictions, okay? But that's not the only case where malpractice could be alleged by someone who is convicted of a crime.
Sure, absolutely. And I believe in that instance you would need to look at what are the actual damages that are being assessed here, because in that case there would have to be some form of injury. So we would have to analyze, okay, what is the actual injury here and what are the damages being asserted? And that could vary greatly as to the separate criminal claims and convictions that we're looking at in this hypothetical. So I believe we still need to undertake the analysis of what is the actual committed, the two actual convictions, and is that activity causally related to the damages being sought for the third charge that is perceived damages and he's alleging innocence of. So if that, does that adequately answer your question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Additionally, Your Honors, I would like to propose this possibly concerning hypothetical in that if the petitioner's argument, as he asserts, essentially the petitioner's primary argument is that we should group all crimes that are brought within a single criminal complaint, and you must assert innocence to every single one of them. Now, the troubling hypothetical that comes up with that is there may be a scenario where someone is representing, a criminal defense attorney is representing their client who is charged with trespass and charged with first-degree murder. So here we have extreme degrees of culpability and what our justice system punishes on. And an experienced criminal attorney may be very well aware of the facts that perhaps his client is going to be found guilty or perhaps may plead later to that lesser offense. Well, if that's the case and if the petitioner's argument is to be accepted, well, then there is no accountability for an attorney's negligence as to anything related to that representation on the much more serious and much more severe first-degree murder charge. So in that instance, we have a loss of accountability. And that goes back to what the Hicks Court is actually... The Hicks Court is certainly concerned with criminal culpability and ensuring that that is not rewarded monetarily. However, the court, I believe, and just the legal malpractice rule in general, is concerned with holding attorneys accountable for negligent conduct and ensuring that their clients are represented and damages aren't significantly incurred due to that negligence. Additionally, Your Honors, I would like to address the petitioner's argument that in his briefing that Mr. Jama had not actually asserted his innocence. I don't believe this court should examine that as it's without merit. Mr. Jama's complaint has asserted numerous times throughout it that he was actually innocent of the sexual assault offenses and that he did not commit a crime and that he did not commit the sexual assault and that while there was sexual contact, it was consensual, and there was consent involved. And looking at the motion to dismiss, all well-pleaded facts are considered accepted as true, as well as reasonable inferences, and that is from Data Key Partners.
Did you also allege that she was not so intoxicated that she could not, that she was not so intoxicated that her consent was valid?
So I believe that is not what Mr. Jama is asserting. That is taken in the context of what could have been argued at the criminal trial.
Well, that's what he was charged with, though, was having sexual intercourse with a woman who was so drunk she couldn't have said yes, even if she said yes. Couldn't have said it in a legal sense. So I guess my question to you was, did you allege in your pleadings that she was not so drunk that she could not have given legal consent?
Mr. Jama alleged that there was consent. So Mr. Jama alleged that she consented and that he consented and that consensual
You're answering a different question than I'm asking, but that's fine.
So I apologize. It's just
that's okay. That's all right.
So in conclusion, Your Honors, the split innocence case is one that does not occur all that often. However, Wisconsin case law and controlling case law has given us a blueprint for how we should examine the split innocence issue. This is established in Hicks, this is established in Talmadge, and this is established in Skinjaleski. And all these considerations shape and form the actual innocence rule in Wisconsin and give us a detailed map as to how to navigate the split innocence issue, not only in this matter, but in future matters. And for that, we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision and remand back to the Circuit Court. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer right now.
All right, I think not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Engel.
May it please the court once again. Mr. Jama got the remedy that, or obtained the post-conviction relief that the law considers sufficient to cure the harm of incompetent representation. I'd just like to call again attention to the fact that Skinjaleski advises that there just will not be exceptions to the actual innocence rule. And I point out that the actual innocence rule is about more than just conviction. And Justice Grassel Bradley's colloquy was instructive. It's about what we can swallow as a matter of public policy. And to allow criminals to recover in malpractice for crimes against the same victim or as the ones that they're convicted of, it seems to me runs afoul of Hicks and probably Skinjaleski as well. Getting to Justice Rogensack's inquiry about the level of intoxication, if you look at the amended complaint, the fourth claim for relief is that Attorney Gonzalez failed to engage an expert to opine that someone can be drunk enough not to remember what happened, but still sober enough to consent. That's a difficult needle to thread, and it's made no easier by the fact that we're now 9 years down the road. But I think that's an acknowledgement that what his defense was about was not, I didn't do it. It was about, there should be reasonable doubt here. And that, to me, is a different kind of category.
Counsel, let me just ask a quick hypothetical here. I'm going to slightly change the facts of this case, but assume Mr. Jama showed up at the home. Assume we're not dealing with a sexual assault. He had whatever kind of interaction there, took a video game console. Later, a boyfriend came home and killed her. Okay? He ends up getting charged with that crime. He spends 20 years in prison. And his attorney simply didn't do the necessary inquiry. Everyone would agree with that. All right. And under the law, which is a high standard, but for the attorney's lack of diligence, or the attorney's negligence, to be more specific, he would not have spent that time in prison. His life is, dramatically shaken by that. Under your approach, he would have no claim. Under maybe a transactional rated approach, he would have no claim. Does that comport with public policy in your view?
I'm not sure that the transactionally related approach would bar his claim because the acts were not transactionally related. It was a different person who did the crime. So I'm not sure that in that...
Well, under the charges, he was charged with going there, in my hypothetical, stealing the video game console and killing somebody over the course of some tussle or fight. So that would have been the allegation, in fact, the thing he was convicted of under my hypothetical. But he was innocent wholly of any of the violence. He just took property that wasn't his. That part happened.
Yeah, so you're right. The accusations are transactionally related. But I wonder if he wouldn't be able to undo that post-conviction by, if it's established that it was not he who did the second crime.
But if the argument is either transaction-related or if it's all part of the same collection of crimes, there is no claim. I think that he would not be able to bring a... He would not be able to bring a malpractice claim because of that here. I mean, it's more exaggerated facts than we have here. We have some factual complications, and obviously there's matters of proof. But under what I'm laying out as a hypothetical, I think the principle that you've established, or under a transactional-related approach, he would have no claim under those circumstances.
I'm not sure I buy the premise of the hypothetical, and I'm not an expert enough criminal lawyer to say one way or another. It seems to me that if you could establish that there was no transactional relatedness, you could probably get around that. But I'll take your hypothetical for what it is, and you know, assume that you're correct for the purposes of this answer, and say, yes, you're right. I would say there's no claim there. Because to me, and this is what I'm urging to the court, the policy that gives us finality, that gives us efficiency, that gives us consistency, is the one to pick here. And if we want a nuanced rule, that's what the legislature should craft. And I see my light has gone off, so.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you for very interesting arguments and briefs on this issue. We appreciate you being here today. Those of you who are waiting to ask Justice Bradley your really tough question. She will be out shortly. But you can stretch, you can stand, you can move around a little bit because you've been sitting very quietly and nicely during these arguments. So we will reconvene in closed conference 1:30. Have a good day, everyone.
Attorney Engel, I apologize if I was kind of short with you.